Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of React Native Radio. Today on our panel, we have Charles Max Wood.
Hey, folks, big announcement. We just launched the Clean Coders podcast. First episode's with Bob Martin, Uncle Bob Martin. So go check that out, devchat.tv/clean-coders.
And I'm Josh Justice, happy to be here. And today our special guest is Josh Warwick. Josh, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and who you are and what you do?
Hey, so I'm Josh. This is my first time on the podcast, so excuse any bad phrasing. So I'm a software developer from England. I work for a company called Theodo. We recently started our new US venture in New York. Currently has about 7 people. What we do is we're an agency trying to help our clients deliver products super fast and using kind of the latest web technologies. So it's moving towards more of a serverless domain. But our default stack at the moment is kind of Django, React, and then React Native on the mobile side.
When I'm building a new product, G2i is the company that I call to help me find a developer who can build it. G2i is a hiring platform run by engineers that matches you with React, React Native, GraphQL, and mobile developers that you can trust. Whether you are a new company building your first product or an established company that wants additional engineering help, G2i has the talent you need to accomplish your goals. Go to g2i.co to learn more about what G2i has to offer. In my experience, G2i has linked me up with experienced engineers that can fit my budget. And the G2i staff are friendly and easy to work with. They know how product development works and can help you find the perfect engineer for your stack. Go to g2i.co to learn more about G2i.
We have a bunch of different sister startups inside our model. So things called BAM. They focus predominantly on mobile in France. Zakara, they are a data science orientated spin-off. And a bunch of other ones as well, but won't go into too much detail. And so I've been a web developer now for about 3 years, studied at the University of Oxford, studied computer science. And I recently tweeted I first went into computer science when I kind of like programmed a computer virus, not really a virus, just a kind of a shortcut. It was on Windows, a shortcut to the log off command. And so called it games, attached a file, and then sent it around to everyone. And apparently that was deemed a virus by the IT department. It's quite funny at the time, but yeah, I think that's the software development is the path for me. And so, yeah, in more recent times, focused on React Native development. I'm kind of the offline mode, so did a talk at the React Advanced conference in London, and more recently, kind of looking at kind of more mentorship and management topics. Yeah, might be a bit of a long intro, but there you go.
Yeah, that's great. We wanted to bring you on to talk about that talk from React Advance London about offline React Native apps. And I watched it and it was really great. I felt like it really hit the mindset, like the big topics and themes to think about. And one of the things you emphasized in the talk is that there's not just one simple answer for offline. Like there's this mental model you need to have and to think and design and make judgment calls about how you approach offline in your applications. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. I think the thing I wanted to get across in the first few parts is that it was kind of like offsetting the kind of thought process in an easier way to the designers somewhat. And so rather than taking on that task of understanding what it means to program this offline mode, you kind of just like push it away. And so it's only getting more complicated when you actually take on that task. Yeah.
You started out the talk with an illustration of sort of a sliding scale of apps and how they approach online and the needs that they have. And so sort of one end was apps that didn't really need online and offline at all. And the other end was apps that were very dependent on being online. Can you talk a bit about apps that might fall at different points on that scale?
So I started talking about, it kind of like really varies depending on the application. So if you're building something that is purely offline, it could be a game, something like a Sudoku or something like that. That is pure offline. But actually, it's more easier to think about because there is no online element to sync with. What I wanted to kind of talk about is the apps that are kind of like online only or their content is online, but you want them to use offline. And this is like a daily struggle for me when I get the tube in. That's the London Metro equivalent. And so half my apps work, half of them don't. Basically, my LinkedIn, it doesn't really work when I'm trying to upload the content. The best one example I have is my Twitter. Twitter will load enough tweets for me to read between the stops, enough images that I can see who the people are, And sometimes even loads tweets and replies themselves. If I accidentally click on one, forgetting I'm offline, that it's already loaded. To me, like, that's the cleanest user experience in the apps I actually use. And so Twitter is like my go-to example. I think a funny anecdote is that when I was preparing the presentation, I actually was recording videos of like all of the different offline modes I liked and didn't like. And so on LinkedIn, they have one, which is you send a post and you have to, it just stays at the top of the page until you reconnect. And then you can retry it and et cetera until you're online. And actually, what I didn't realize is that it posted my tweet, my LinkedIn post, as soon as it connected. And I had no idea. And so as me being a user, one of my friends commented like, "What are you talking about? This talk's tomorrow." I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to have to go and delete that." So it was such a weird experience for me. It's like no one wants to experience that when they're kind of just living their lives every day. And the clarity of, basically the importance for me is the clarity to the user about what's happening with the offline state is kind of one of the key points.
Yeah, one of the things that I find a lot of times with user experience that holds people up, and your example with LinkedIn, you know, having it post without you really realizing that's what it was doing. It's not even that it's communicating or not communicating well what it's doing, as much as it did something that you didn't expect. And that's where the disconnect is for people, right? And so, yeah, the UX should be telling you this is going to post when you reconnect, right? And so then it sets the expectation and then fulfills it. But sometimes there's just a manner in which mobile apps tend to operate. And so you can get away with the shortcut where you don't even have to give them an indicator. And then at the end of the day, it does what they expect them to do. And so you're training them along with all of the other apps they use to expect it to work in that way. But in this case, you didn't know. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, that went live. And yeah, you kind of had to deal with that.
It's an interesting point you raised about the kind of abstraction layers we build with our interfaces themselves as well. I was recently talking to someone who has a friend at Facebook who was doing some work in kind of a remote region and designing some user interfaces for them. And it's a completely different way of working. Like here, we have carousels, we have really quite high level abstractions for user interfaces. But over there, you're like, well, what's a button? And so, like, it sounded really fascinating. Little sliders, a bit interesting.
I'm not a very experienced designer or UX person at all. And so to me, thinking about the concerns of offline seems very challenging, because it's like, if I'm thinking about, okay, I'm online, I have a form, I submit the form, I get a success state, an error state, it's very limited the different possible states you could be in. But it's almost like when you're thinking about offline behavior, it's a lot more states. And there's also sort of this time separation aspect, thinking about, does the user still, for my application, for my specific data, will the user still want to submit that same data 1 minute later, 1 day later? Or are there things that might have changed where the user will want to see the current state of the system and then decide? It's just this combinatorial explosion of things to think about. So it seems challenging. And it's I always see the value of designers because I'm very poor at design. But the need for that just seems like even so much more for an app that has offline features, for someone who really has an expertise to think through those user interface concerns.
Well, thing that stands out to me too is that you can't even necessarily make a general assumption, right? 1 day, a couple hours, whatever, is going to be different for Twitter than it will be for LinkedIn, than it will be for whatever other system you're interfacing with, than it will be for your blog, right? And so, yeah, you can't just say, okay, well, we're just going to go with the standard back off, because your system and your use case is going to be different. And so, you know, 2 hours may be a ton of time for a tweet and may not be nearly enough time where you just want to make it automatic for a blog post that needs to go live, you know. So anyway, it just kind of occurs to me too. A lot of times you can extrapolate what the general case is. And here I think it's a little bit harder. It's more nuanced.
Yeah, I think it massively depends on like what your app is itself. I think that was part of the annoying part of preparing a talk. It's always annoying to say, well, it depends on your own use case. But in this case, it really does. Like it matters completely about what your user's trying to do and the contextual information behind that.
So what information do you put into making that decision? Because it seems like it's something that kind of comes with experience, and I don't have a ton. So help me out with this.
For example, we were working on a healthcare app recently where support workers would engage with customers, like parents or people. And basically it was just a blog posting app, which we called Moments. And so they wanted some offline functionality. And actually for them, they just very quickly wanted to call the moment and get back to giving support and care. And so for that use case, it's, you know, store that content on the phone, just push it to the server. If there's duplicates, then later on they can go and both go through them and kind of undo it. And you know, everyone's under time pressure these days, so you can't build the perfect solution the first time round. And actually that sufficed for them, like just something to quickly record and push, or just keep pushing until it's done. That was sort of worked for them. So where you can go back and retrain the history. Whereas if you're doing something like Twitter, then if you make a mistake, then you've got to delete the tweet, rewrite it. So yeah, it completely depends on the use case. I think it would be another good example. A lot of the time it's trying to push all of your content to be available, like features that you have, thinking about them on a off, okay, is this offline like capable, rather than trying to think about it at the app level. So it's like, okay, we're adding the ability to for a user to do, don't know. The only examples that come to mind are ones that are inherently kind of need an offline focus on them. But it's, you need to focus on the feature itself and how you're going to make that offline. Like, what's the user experience when I'm on the tube? It's like a thing that runs through my head when I'm thinking about this. And it depends on the client for us. So sometimes they care massively about their UX, UI. Sometimes they don't. That's yeah, it really depends on the use case again.
That's a good transition into the different approaches you listed out in your talk. There's like six different aspects or so of offline applications. And the first one was feature restrictions, kind of stopping users from doing things that they aren't able to do offline and giving it a good user experience around it. What like examples have you seen of cases where apps do not give a good experience to blocking users out of features they can't do while offline?
So I think for me, it's those annoying ones. It's like the half-assed, half-half. The most annoying as a user are the ones that are kind of half-baked. They're the ones which it looks like you're succeeding, but you forget that you're offline and then things don't work. They're the ones that really frustrate me personally. As kind of my developer mindset, you very quickly want to be saying, actually, no, like let's just cut this feature back and give it, not let them do it. And so actually one of the first things to do with our clients as soon as they start talking about offline mode is say, well, actually, let's just say, okay, look, a little crow dinosaur example, like saying, you know, you can't view this page. This is fine. And just like letting people know, being informative is kind of the key thing there. So across a lot of our apps, we do that. It's just saying, okay, this feature's unavailable. Can't do this right now. Sorry. That's quite easy to do with React Native. You just listen to whether the device is online or offline. You can block off the whole app if you need to, which we've done in the past as well.
So I was going to ask if you're using proactively checking net info or some other option to see if your device thinks it has a real internet connection. Do you combine that with like proactively checking if you're offline and then also responding to if you do make a request to the web and it comes back with a connectivity error? Do you find your apps kind of do being proactive and reactive?
Yeah, typically proactive and reactive. So having like an error, a snack bar or something like that on the network failure. And then also having like a snack bar or something else, toast maybe saying you're offline. I think that is the most effective one of just having a simple listener for the net info and then popping out a snack bar saying you're offline. It's just letting your user know. I think it's like such a simple feature. It may as well, you gain so much from such a little piece of code, you may as well put it in.
The next approach you mentioned was caching. Tell us what you mean by caching.
So this is storing similar to caching on the web side of things for those people that aren't front-end web developers. Oh, sorry, for those that are only front-end and not on the back-end. So a common situation on the back-end is to kind of cache requests for data. So if you're Instagram and you're serving out like a million requests for some celebrity's page, probably going to want to like not hit the database on every single one. So caching is like a way of storing for like, okay, for the next minute, it's just going to be data and we don't care if it changes. So it's a way of increasing the speed by storing more data in a separate place. So you can apply that same principle on a user's mobile device. So you can store content that is kind of like 5 minutes old when they were active on the internet to use in the app later on.
Yeah, that makes sense. One question that I have is that, I mean, caching, we always talk about caching as this, you know, it's a short word, right? And oh, we're just going to do caching. And then it's like, okay, well, what do we cache and how long do we hold it? And when do we change it? And how often do we check with the back end to make sure that the cache is right? And so, yeah, I'm curious, do you have strategies that you particularly like here? And how do you mitigate against maybe having stale data and making sure that the back end is up to date so that nobody else has stale data?
Yeah, I think there's like a famous computer science quote, which is like, caching is easy, but caching validation is impossible, something like that.
Yeah.
So basically say, you don't know when your date, when's the right time to update your stale data? I think this is a hard question. It's for most applications who are doing very simple things, it's fine to just store like the list of tweets and actually just invalidate it as soon as you hit the network again. But if you're dealing with more time sensitive data, then you do want to kind of inform the, I would always probably inform the user that, okay, the last 5 minutes, the last refresh was this date. Again, like just informative apps are key in this area.
Right. And I kind of like the idea too of, for your Twitter example, you open the app and it knows that it's going to open up the home screen. It's going to show you a bunch of things and you're likely to take a couple of different actions. So it gets what it needs for that. And then, yeah, you know, periodically or when your connection comes back, you know, whichever is soonest, then it goes and it says, okay, this is what I got. Is there anything new?
Or yeah. Yeah. I think in general, that's the approach. That's actually the only approach I've actually used. So there's been less of a need to choose what to cache on the device. And just as soon as you've got network, fetch policy. Don't bother caching things and only storing things. Which is kind of, I don't know, it's a very much lazy approach. But for most of the apps we work on, it makes sense. I think if you're dealing with people with low internet connectivity, then it's really not helpful for that. And then you do have to start being selective and choosing which data you want to kind of persist in between those moments.
Your talk mentioned a few different libraries that can help with caching, Redux Persist, Apollo Cache Persist, others depending on the data layer you're using. I've had a lot of success with Redux Persist. It's been really great. I'm kind of curious if you would just say, hey, like, you know, it's so easy to integrate Redux Persist. Would you recommend like, hey, just about any app like this using Redux, for example, drop in Redux Persist in general, or are there concerns where it's like, oh, that can make something tricky. Like maybe don't always do it, or maybe don't persist your entire Redux store.
Depends what you're doing. If you're, we've had problems in the past where we've accidentally put, say accidentally, it's on purpose and trying to be hacky, put non-serializable stuff in our store. For our crimes. And obviously Redux Persist, when it tries to store this, has a completely freaks out. There are actually ways you can override the behavior for those specific keys to say, actually just convert it to this thing, convert it back. But actually, this, you hit this problem if you're using like Moment, which is like a date library. So if you put Moments in your Redux store and then Redux Persist breaks when you load your app, it's a bit of an annoyance to then debug what's happening, but very commonly happens on projects. So that's kind of like one reason I put one gotcha with it. But other than that, I think it's worth generally having all the time. It is like a bit, people are kind of moving away from Redux now and kind of wanting to use more hooks type things. One thing I did really recently was actually just set up a hook which stored it in local storage, stored all of the state stay there. It was a really simple hook, which was quite nice. I think like simplicity kind of makes a lot of sense here. Unless you're doing a large amount of, like data management yourself, then you just want to store a bit of data. I think like Amazon Cognito does this with your user information and your Cognito pools. So if Amazon do it, then it's fine for our clients.
Infinite Red has been designing and shipping and building web and mobile applications for 10 years. They're experts in React Native and passionate advocates for remote work. They also host North America's only React Native conference, Chain React, attended by hundreds of developers all over the world. I actually went this last year. It was a ton of fun. If you start a project after hearing about them on this podcast, they'll give you 2 free tickets. You can learn more at radio.infinite.red.
The next approach you talked about was request queuing. And I think this is a bit less familiar than the concept of caching. Tell us what request queuing means.
So this means essentially, I think there's another word for it, which is like optimistic updating. It's a very similar principle. Which rather than kind of you're offline, it's letting users actively do something when you're when they're offline. So rather than just like having cached data you can see, you also let them post another thing. And actually, you might go as far as displaying that in the list with a little star next to it, but it's not actually sent off to the server yet. And then the request queuing part is repeated, which is like putting that in a queue when you're online, pushing it off the server. And that's generally quite effective for kind of like blog posty apps, things that you're kind of subscribing to, data that's kind of, you know, you're just doing simple gets and posts to. It's pretty effective. So you can just queue now in Redux as well. You can do like a little wrapper around it. I think there's Redux Offline lets you do this. So then stores like a queue of the kind of actions that have happened and then replays them all once you're online and connected again. It's quite an effective strategy. It can leave you, if you choose to deal with the fact that you're doing optimistic updating, then it can be a lot more complicated as each feature needs to be optimistically updated. It's not a catch-all solution. But in general, if you're doing like lists and gets and posts, then you can make it a bit generic.
Mentioning gets and posts, that made me think, as I was thinking through this topic, it seemed like situations that are like append only, where it's like, oh, I'm adding new things, like a new blog post, a new tweet, seems like it could be easier to do request queuing. Whereas situations where you're editing, you're deleting, you're connecting data in a related way, it gets a lot more complex. Yeah. And you mentioned conflict resolution coming up further. So like if the way you interact with this data could lead to conflicts, that has a lot more complexity. It may even come to the point maybe you don't want to do that offline at that point. So this is a great example of how it's hard to be general. Like the way you use your data differs. And this is when you're online all the time, it's almost like you think of your data as a very static thing. It's like, I just have my records. I just have my data here. And anything that's changing it is temporary and transient in memory. Whereas, you know, when you have to queue a request is a change. And so you're representing that. And I can see GraphQL mutations, Redux actions, those are concepts built into those architectures that relate to this, that capture something, that changes something. So that's, yeah. I think, a case where it's helpful to be using Redux or GraphQL because there is a built-in concept of a change that's being made instead of you having to come up with and record the concept of a change yourself.
Yeah, yeah. One of the Apollo does it really well. I got it, like the GraphQL movement is something that is really worth investigating or doing proof of concepts on. It does clean up a lot of the, like, the way you think about everything is like a mutation or a query. There's only two things. You're either changing things or you're getting things. Mm-hmm. The kind of signs of what you just said there is makes things a lot simpler. And as a developer, I'm like, simple is, give me the simplest thing possible. So yeah, I can definitely resonate with that.
You know, a lot of times when I think about these requests and conflicts, I think about just what can we detect in the code? Like, what, you know, from a code standpoint, there's a conflict in the data here. But I'm starting to think recently about another concept, which is, you know, maybe there's no conflict in the code, but maybe the user just would make a different decision if they saw the latest data. Like, oh, I went offline with an old version of the data and I decided to change something. But now that I'm back online and I see what's new, I would no longer make that decision. Like maybe you decide to make a payment for something, but once you see that your account balance has gone down, oh, I'm not going to spend that money anymore. Are you seeing that concept coming up in your designs and what you have to think about, the idea of it's just purely the issue of what the user knows and what they would decide to do?
Yeah, I haven't come across it on the projects I've worked on. I think it's quite complex for displaying the user, okay, this versus this. I think I mentioned a library in the talk for the conflict resolution section, which can manage that for you. But things like use Notion for our internal documentation here. And so that app, you go offline and update it, you know, it's quite nice, updates it and it's trying to sync, it has a little loading indicator, but like it doesn't have active conflict resolution. I'm not sure if I'd want it. Like, that's the thing, is like, as long as it's not deleting stuff, you can go ahead and start removing things when you have a persistent connection. But yeah, it's a really hard topic, and fortunately it only applies to most notes apps or kind of things where you need to edit things. So it's not widely adopted, but if you need to do it, it's likely that it's going to be a pain.
Yeah, I was thinking about, I've been working on, I've mentioned on the show in recent episodes, working on a to-do list app that has offline support. Just doing that stereotypical to-do list app that everybody builds. But it's, I'm particularly a nerd about to-do list apps. And also it's been fun to be able to kind of work with offline features in a very constrained environment. And so thinking about to-do lists, I was thinking about how in this specific domain, I can make decisions about how to resolve conflicts. Like if I, in one place I edit a to-do and in another place I mark it as complete, then it's like, okay, well, that's two different fields. Like there's a complete flag and then there's other fields. So just merge those changes. If I actually delete the record, then it can just go away. And so an update can be thrown out. So that's fine there, but that's all specific to to-dos, whereas a record in a different type of system, you might need to make totally different decisions there.
It could also be the case where you didn't want to, you edit a to-do, which means that if you previously, I mean, you mark something as complete, but then you edit it later on, forgetting that that's done. And then you accidentally forget to do one of your do's. So then there's actually a conflict between editing and checklisting. And so you have to then manage this complexity as well. So it's just, you can really like tunnel into complexity when trying to deal with complex resolution.
That's a great example. Yeah. I mean, like, as that's an edge case about it that I didn't consider. And it might not come up until a user loses data.
Yeah. And that's the only point you'll know about it as well when you've upset customers on the phone.
I know something that I haven't played with much, but a friend of mine, I think I've referenced his video in a past episode, shared about was about the concept of conflict-free replicated data types, CRDTs. Have you worked with these before at all or read about them?
No, actually, no.
I'll make sure we get the link in the pic section so folks can see it. It's the brief version, and all I really know is the summary because I haven't worked with them myself, is that it's data types that are set up in the way they're built to prevent conflicts automatically. And so, yes, two users could do something that their intents may conflict. So that, you know, you can't prevent that. But if it comes to like a string, like you might have a CRDT that's like a representation of a string you could use for notes apps. And then they have ways to decide if one user types a change here and another one types it at the same place, it can determine a consistent way to put those together so that, you know, the two users' devices won't make opposite decisions about how to resolve them. You will get a consistent result in the end where they will both put the changes in the same order. And so it, you know, again, users may need to review it after the fact and be like, oh, we both changed something and that's not what we intended. But you won't run into a situation where the two devices have diverged and they have different, they have resolved a conflict in opposite ways that makes things diverge more and more over time.
Yeah. Okay. That's super interesting.
Yeah. I'll get the link to his talk about that.
Yeah. I think that is very relatable to the, viewing like append only type situation. Like it makes it so much simpler. Maybe that does simplify your use cases. Like you can do the optimistic updating using the same logic as the way you actually update on the back end. I think the consistency is the kind of critical element there where you want to always be displaying the same information. Otherwise people go up on tangents with whatever they're in conflict with. So definitely sounds interesting. I'd like to see an implementation of it.
Yeah, the implementations tend to vary data type by data type. Like I was talking to my friend a few weeks ago and he mentioned just, you know, academic research that's being done on how to have a CRDT that handles JSON-like objects in general or that handles arrays in general. It's something that, again, case, you know, it's hard to be general, but case by case, people are building these data types that could help. That actually reminds me, when you were talking about the different backend options, you listed REST and GraphQL, and also listed Firebase. I've been playing with CouchDB, you know, the sort of browser and React Native way to connect to CouchDB databases. And I know that it was designed from the ground up for synchronization. I'm curious if you've played with CouchDB at all in React Native or elsewhere.
I haven't actually played with it, no. I think someone spoke to me after talk about it, and I was like, I hadn't realized to the extent of which it did all the synchronization between different devices. But it sounds really fascinating. Definitely something I want to use, or at least have a little proof of concept with. I think these tools are great when you start diving deep into, okay, well, actually, this is a huge number of our users have really bad internet connection. There's something we really need to prioritize technically here. So it's good to know that there's in-depth solutions are available for it. even if you, it's something to spend lots of time on, people have put good thought into as well.
I'm curious about Firebase. I've used Firebase at hackathons and on side projects and things like that. Coming from my background as a backend developer, I like owning the database. I like having control. And so even NoSQL, like CouchDB and PouchDB is like new to me. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'll try it. But the fact that Firebase is, you know, it's proprietary, it's owned by Google, the data is in Google's systems and things like that. It feels a bit more siloed. So I'm curious if you or your clients have used Firebase for production applications, and if that's worked well, or if like the siloing has ended up kind of causing challenges for them.
That's a really interesting question. So we actually do a lot of serverless projects at the moment, which has this whole concept of vendor lock-in, which is essentially what you're describing with the siloing. So all of the data is now, okay, your functions, they run on Amazon hardware, they're stored on Amazon Lambda functions. They only run on Lambda functions. They, you know, using DynamoDB, which is literally Amazon specific, can't really migrate that away to a different NoSQL easily. So it's part, I think it forms part of that large conversation of, are we willing to let cloud providers kind of, you get so much free for it, but the cost is you're never going to leave them. And so when they increase the prices in 5 years, when you're so bought into it, how does that affect your business? Do you have the opportunity to scale out? So like the advice, so part of the sales team here is to kind of lead up the technical side of sales. And the advice that I give for that is, to be honest, like most people when they come to us when they're building things are like early stage, like either in just about to start to scale. So it's generally fine to lock into a vendor at that stage. The likelihood is if you're successful, you have enough money to invest in the technology to move away if you need to. And so sometimes it's hard to convince people to that reality or think they're not in that. But honestly, I think that's the best of money safe advice. It is a concern of like, well, Amazon can just switch off the service at any point. But yeah, I think the savings you get in that startup-y MVP space are just invaluable relative to managing your own infrastructure, your own databases. I think that's my view on things.
Yeah, I find that especially convincing when it comes to this offline functionality, just because, implementing it from scratch for you. I mean, you will not implement Firebase from scratch. Like, it is not going to happen. I'm coming from a SQL background. I'm very comfortable with SQL. As I've been thinking about these things, just seeing the fact that, like, you know, distributed databases are architecturally very hard for SQL. No concepts like synchronization like this are built in, and just the exponential amount of effort that would go into building it. It's like at that point, you are not building your product, like you're building a synchronization solution. And so that's enough to convince me. It's like, well, and this gets to the idea of how it's hard to be general again. If your application really doesn't need a whole lot of synchronization on offline, maybe a REST or maybe GraphQL is totally fine. And you just use those off the shelf systems and you just add in the little Redux persist or just like a little bit of queuing up of requests. But if it's something where for your application, the synchronization, the offline is super crucial for it, then it's like, okay, it's worth being, even if it's more expensive to be on a different backend platform, even if you personally or your team is not as familiar with it, or it's more risky, but it's like, this is going to give a synchronization that is just not going to be possible if we build off of SQL and REST. So if nothing else, at least in the case of this offline synchronization topic, I find it very, very convincing to use the tool that's going to give you what you need because it's the only option.
Yeah. I think GraphQL provides like a nice middle ground between kind of you getting the advantage of things like Firebase, which gives you like basically all the offline mode for free, handles all the connections for you. It's so nice to use. But GraphQL, you do have to do a bit of work to set up those subscriptions and kind of mutations queries and those resolvers on your backend side. And on the front end, you do still have to then do the optimization dating. But you still have to do that kind of in Firebase as well, a little bit. So GraphQL is kind of this best of both worlds at the moment, which is something I need to put more time into. I've used it a lot on my current project, but kind of it's something which is, I don't know, I it's not really run off with everything yet. I think there's still hesitation from people of moving into GraphQL lands. I definitely have that. I can't really put my finger on what it is either.
Yeah, thankfully there is enough momentum in the GraphQL world that is like, I'm not concerned that it's just going to stop being popular, you know, and I'm not concerned that there's not great tools. Like, I mean, Apollo in particular, I know some folks like other solutions, but Apollo is very, very popular. And one thing that really draws me to GraphQL is the subscriptions. You know, it's one of the kind of highest level of abstractions over live updates, I feel like. The alternative seems to me for most of the, well, I mean, you got Firebase, you got real time, it's all there for you. Same with PouchDB, actually. It will synchronize up in real time if you just flip it on. But other than those solutions, it's like I'm working with WebSockets directly if I need to build something. And so the idea that GraphQL subscriptions are there, they're more well-defined, there's client and server libraries that are handling that for me, it just gives me a greater degree of confidence that the connectivity, you know, connectivity drops, reliability there are going to be handled well. So, I mean, I'm a big fan of kind of going up the stack of abstractions whenever I can. And so when GraphQL is offering me higher abstractions like that, that makes it real appealing to me.
It's cool. It's quite interesting because like with the increase like 5G, things like that, having more real-time connections, there's definitely like an increase in space for that kind of subscription service. So it's interesting to see how that might expand. Like in the future, maybe it's just only subscription, only subscriber things. It could be an interesting interface to use. It's quite interesting.
The last approach you listed was the topic of developer mindset. Tell us what you meant by that.
So this is kind of like self-encompassing of like most things you talked about. Like don't make things too complicated. Like you want to go into these kind of you like talk to your product owner with the mindset of going, what about the offline users? What happens when I go through the tube? Just like having that foresight in you to go, actually, yeah, what about this? And it's the same thing as like a developer when you speak to product people, you're like, this edge case is a random weird thing that might happen. Let them know about it, they can prioritize it. I think that's kind of the idea there. I think it is really about collaboration between dev and product to kind of solve this problem. But as a developer, you know all that you can learn all the intricacies about what different options are available to you. And I think that we should know that and then advise it to the product owners.
Hey folks, this is Charles Maxwood, and I just launched my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. It's up on Amazon. We self-published it. I would love your support. If you want to go check it out, you can find it there, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. Have a good one. Max out.
I've heard of other folks on other podcasts and kind of in the developer community in the last year or so talking about product thinking and the idea that developers should not just be, you know, receiving requirements and just build what you tell me, but that we should be taking the initiative to think in the way you're describing. And I think the offline functionality is a particular area where we can help. Maybe we don't know the customers as well as the product owner or even the UX developers. Maybe we don't know visuals as well as the designer, but we might know some of these mechanics about offline functionality better than them because it's newish, because it is the paths are not well paved. And so, you know, a lot of apps don't have any offline functionality. Others are kind of reinventing the wheel as they go. So it's new ground, and it's ways that we can really add value for companies. I think it's ways that we can show that, you know, grow as developers and kind of show the value that we're adding. That's very helpful when you're looking for a new place to work. If you can talk about the cool offline functionality you've been able to build and have a conversation in an interview about, yeah, it's complicated. Like, here's the judgment calls we had to make and here's what we would have done differently. It's like, wow, that's, you know, most applicants have never done anything offline. So that's really unique. I could see just so much value that we can add by looking into this stuff. And to me, it's just personally interesting as someone who really enjoys React Native and really likes, you know, I want the apps that I build and the apps that we build to be completely on par or surpassing just other regular native apps. And so offline is an area we can do, like you said in the subtitle of your talk, get beyond a web mentality where we were assuming that we're online all the time and really add a robustness that's really going to help users and create a great experience.
Yeah, that's the thing I kind of want. The one thing I didn't quite explore when I was preparing for the talk is like that native app mindset. Like this, I surely have been a problem for 10 years since people have been making apps. But I didn't find very much material on it. So it is just like a built-in expectation for native app developers, I assume. But some of the apps I mentioned aren't built in React Native. So I think it's just a commonality shared between. But if you know any resources that people, from people who are native apps, who written them. I'd also like to check those out.
Yeah, I'm going to ask around where I work and see if anybody has anything. I know one of my coworkers used to work at Realm, which is a, you know, mobile app centric database solution that had some of this functionality. I think they have web functionality now, but they started with a real iOS and Android emphasis. So he may have some resources that I can get into the show notes after the fact.
Cool. That'd be good.
So one thing that I'm wondering about with this is it feels like with... And this is kind of up at kind of the general level. It feels like with a lot of the things we're doing, whether it's React Native or web or other things, you know, it's all right, well, we got to be testing. We got to be doing accessibility. We got to be doing, you know, this bit and that bit and the other bit. So where in that priority queue do we put offline functionality, right? Is it near the top with sort of the testing and reliability and good UX design? Is it somewhere in the middle, you know, where we're, you know, we're looking at, okay, we need to add this in so people can use it. You know, I kind of put accessibility in there because the app will function without accessibility. It just doesn't work well for everybody. This, you know, and offline kind of fits that. Or, you know, are we down where it's like, okay, well, we've handled all the important stuff. Now let's make it work offline.
It kind of depends where you want to split it. I think you kind of hinted it on it there. Like you could make it similar to accessibility by saying, well, actually, it's only some of our users are offline. So if 10% are off, it's only 2%. So that's how we'll prioritize it. You can prioritize it in a different way and say, well, actually, it's kind of like a minimum requirement, the same way we kind of require testing or something like that. I think the basic, just having a pop down if you're offline is probably essential. But yeah, I think it depends on what you're building. Again, like, as like a core principle, probably around accessibility, is probably the same percentage of users it affects. But if your market isn't like EU or UK, US, then if it's something with low points of connectivity, then that's suddenly like 90% of your users. And I'd be more important than the testing side of things. So yeah, I think in the most cases in like UK, US, then it's going to be probably similar to accessibility. But yeah, again, it depends on the application.
Josh, going back to what you were saying about the expectations coming from the native world, I ran into this. I've done a little bit of native iOS development on the side, and I work with a number of native developers that are really, really experienced, and so I get to learn a lot from them. My first side project that I made was a personal wiki app, and the reason I created it, actually, I should plug the existing product that I based it on. It's called VoodooPad, and it's a Mac application where you can create a personal wiki. It's like just a note-taking app, but the pages are linked together. They automatically link as you type in the name of one page, it automatically links to the other. So it's different from Markdown in that regard. It's like, oh, I see the title of a page, I'm going to turn that into a link. So I used that. I was doing some graduate school. It was extremely helpful for my learning. But they didn't have an iOS app at the time. And I really wanted an iPhone app. And then when they created one, it was this mentality that I feel like was the case with Mac apps and, you know, just computer apps back in the day, pre-web era, where it's like, hey, your data is local. You know, your data is on your computer. Like you're editing documents, you're editing files. But even when things started to be online, it's like, well, okay, I've got your database of to-dos or your document. I'm just going to synchronize the document up and synchronize it back down. And so it was like synchronizing the wiki down to the iPhone. But then like conflicts were coming up because it was kind of sending the whole file all at once. And I was also thinking about, as a web developer with a web-centric mindset, is like, I want to pull this up in a web browser. Like these are literally just pages. I want to be able to make a page public. And then people can just go to it like, you know, my note app /Josh/page name and pull it up. I wanted to be able to share pages between different users. So my mindset was very much, it's a web application and it's a database, a relational database. And so it's just interesting to see, VoodooPad has been gradually moving towards making it more online and more synchronized. I haven't done much work on the project, but I kind of moved towards, hey, offline would be nice. Can I do that? But I see a similar trend in, you know, the applications, the circles, the enterprise circles that I work in and startup circles I work in, the mindset these days is generally tends to be, you know, we always connect to a web service, like the data is there on a web service, but there's this other mindset. And depending on the application you're in, you might start more over on that side still where it's like, hey, I'm creating documents. It's a document that's here locally. And secondarily, I might synchronize it up somewhere. Versus thinking of it, it's a JSON blob. It's at a REST service or a GraphQL structure that's coming back. So I still see that sliding scale of people starting from the concept of local documents versus starting from the concept of a web service with JSON data or something else.
Yeah, it's interesting how that ties into kind of the real-time stuff about as mentioned earlier. So if our thing is increasingly moving to be more real-time, to be more kind of this abstract entity, it's actually neither on the server, neither on my device. It's kind of maintained between these events that happen, some sort of projection of them. It could go either way, but the trend seems to be away from like, traditional desktop applications towards web applications. So yeah, it's an interesting one to watch.
Yeah, I think your point there is that when you focus on real time, you mentioned earlier, like, what if everything is over a subscription? What if it's not this distinction between I loaded a bunch of data and then I subscribe to updates, but what if it's just I just subscribe to the data? I think that's probably even a third mental model. Like, I think the differences between that and requesting data from a REST service are big enough that that's going to influence applications in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I definitely do see subscriptions and kind of WebSockets as kind of like this separate third entity that you kind of like, if you use GraphQL, you use queries and mutations, like, oh, subscriptions, we can probably use that. And then dip your toe in like that. Okay, we have to think about this one first. So yeah, we've definitely experienced that.
Cool. Is there anything else about your talk or about the kind of topic of React Native Offline that we didn't hit on you wanted to get to?
I'm not sure. I think the summary is like it does massively depend on your use case. It's always an unhelpful thing to say at the end of the talk. But really, there are simple things you can do in your applications to make it really like friendly for the user. I think comparing it to the accessibility point is like quite a genuine one as well. Like that is what you're doing. You say, okay, these 2% of users, we want to care about them too. And so when you're prioritizing and everyone's in a rush these days, they're the things that you kind of will be thinking about in your priority. So really, that's probably where it comes up. But being able to have that kind of a mindset and say, offline mindset, we can do this thing really simply that gets us 90% of the way there, rather than the product owner thinking it's impossible or a week's worth of work can just be a small ticket. I think that's probably my summary on the topic.
Yeah, I think your talk gave the best possible answer to an it depends situation, and they described what it depends on. And I just want to encourage the listeners to check out your talk. I shared it to our team that I'm on right now because the timing was perfect because we've got some offline functionality coming up that we need to add in. And I think your talk, you give a lot of examples of how to do things with specific technologies or examples of libraries that will help, but you're really hitting heavily on the concepts. And so I think that's going to continue to give it a value and just a great foundation. I mean, I would share this to folks that are doing things on the web, that are using technologies like service workers and local storage, or to folks that are doing native apps. Like, the concepts to think about are going to be the same and are going to endure regardless of what specific technologies you're using to that end. So yeah, I think you explained the it depends quite well.
Thank you very much. Very happy it's useful. And yeah, hopefully it's helpful to people.
If folks want to kind of keep in touch with you or follow along, where can they find you online?
I'm on Twitter, Jaw9C. Same for GitHub. My LinkedIn is Josh Warwick. That's kind of all of my online presence at the moment. I'm actually new to Twitter. So I was in the talk kind of RFP or some call proposals. I used to give a Twitter. So I made one. I spent like 2 months thinking about my name and then just came up with, Jaw9C. Short, simple.
There you go. Well, cool. Let's go to picks. I can start out and share a pick. I did put in the show notes, but I'll mention it. So I found that the talk from my friend that I was referring to, his name is Jonathan Martin. He has kind of a silly talk title. So in my notes, I just summarized it as CRDTs and real-time collaboration. So it's a YouTube talk, and it's a really great, very accessible intro to the topic of CRDTs and some other offline considerations. The other pick is I did a blog post series near the middle of last year, I think, about setting up a Redux data layer. So I walked through a number of features and sort of build it up. And in the end, in the latter few parts of it, I talk about offline functionality as well. So one part about what I call offline reads, so caching. The other part about offline writes is what I refer to request queuing as. And this is a very, like build it yourself in Redux kind of approach. So it kind of like gives you a sense of like, oh, if you are going to build it yourself, here's how to do it. And then at the end, I sort of like point out the combinatorial explosion of the complexity of what you're implementing. And that's when I start to point to some of these other tools, like you mentioned in your talk. But yeah, if folks maybe haven't done almost any Redux at all, or they're just thinking about how Redux is very unstructured, and it's like, how can I go about putting this together? Or I want to take it all the way up to there, even to like, hey, I'm familiar with Redux, but I haven't done things offline. Can I just drop in Redux persist, or are there other considerations to do? The kind of blog post series gets into that. And I had a lot of fun doing it and learning it. So hopefully it would be helpful for folks as well.
Sounds great.
Those are my picks. Josh, how about you?
So recently I've been focusing on more kind of management and kind of coaching and that type of thing. Which I think is like, I've been reading, someone released like a new engineering manager book, like a trial. I want to read that book, but I haven't. So I'm going to suggest another pick, which is 9 Lies About Work. It's kind of based on more factual kind of analysis of kind of people and kind of trying to measure engagement and kind of personality and things like that. And like as a kind of scientist, computer science background, that kind of really resonated with me. And so for the last 3 or 4 months, that's been my primary focus. So yeah, I'd recommend that book, 9 Lies About Work.
Cool. Chuck, how about you?
All right. So I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we just started a new podcast. I've been recording these interviews for a few months. And yeah, we finally got things together and launched. It's the Clean Coders podcast. It is a partnership between Clean Coders and DevChat.tv. So yeah, first episode's with Bob Martin. The third episode was probably one of my favorites. We talked to Chris Powers, and we talked about clean code in the browser, but we also talked about how to level up, how to, you know, lead your team and a bunch of stuff like that. I mean, we kind of covered all sorts of stuff, and it was just, it was amazing. Had a really great conversation with Eric Critchlow about, and he's a native iOS development guy, and he talks about his learning process and things like that in that one. And just, I mean, there are some real gems in these. This week, we're putting one out per day. So by the time you subscribe, because this will come out, you know, best case scenario next week, I think we're like 3 or 4 weeks out. There should be a number of episodes, and they're all just awesome. So yeah, definitely check that out. Another pick that I have, and this is something that we had a discussion at church, and we were talking about how to be better people kind of thing, how to do better at life. And this idea came up where it was just not just find ways to improve, but find ways to improve that are sort of natural to the way that you're living your life, right? And so for me, what it boiled down to was, I was like, I listen to podcasts all day long, right? And, you know, I've been looking for ways to get more spiritual content into my routine. And so me being a podcaster and a programmer who's written a system that builds RSS feeds that you can then hand off to a podcast app. I've been putting together an RSS feed with talks from the church's general conference. And what I guess the idea is not necessarily, you know, this, you know, these talks or anything, though you can find them, just go to churchofjesuschrist.org, click general conference, you'll find them. But mostly it's the idea of working in a way that is natural to what you're doing, right? And so for me, it was, I want more of this content. It's not available as a podcast, but I can find the links to the audio files that I can put into an RSS feed, and then I can set it up to drip one out one a day, right? And so whatever way you want to improve, go find something that just fits into your natural routine and make it happen, right? And so it could be hacking together a podcast feed. It could be, you know, putting a note or, you know, or printing off something that you want to read and sticking it in your, you know, in your clothing that you set out the night before. If that's something that you do, I don't. But I know people that are able to do that, right? And so they stumble across, it's like, oh yeah. And then they'll sit down and read it for a couple of minutes. Or, you know, fit watching a tutorial video into your morning routine or something like that. So however you can do it, you know, but put it in a natural way so that it works with you instead of having to form a new habit, right? So my habit is turn on my podcast and just listen to the next thing on my list. And so now, once a day, the next thing on my list is going to be one of those talks. So anyway, just a life hack.
I don't know if I've ever thought about the general principle of that, going to fit your learning into the way your life operates. But I've definitely seen the benefit from that. I have a number of small kids. I'm commonly carrying around kids and trying to get them to sleep and things like that. And so I like to read a lot. Books that I can read in iBooks or in Kindle are very easy because I've got them right there on my phone. Books that are available only on paper, and I love a number of like classic programming books that are only available on paper, it's much harder for me to get to those. And so just deciding that that's okay, that like I've got some paper books that I want to get to at some point, and so I've just kind of got them set aside, but prioritizing the books that I can get electronically because that's much easier for me to do right now, that really helped me out. And just deciding not to pressure myself over that, but just to go with the flow of what fits well in my life. So yeah, I'm glad to know that principle in general, to kind of be looking at my learning in that way.
Yeah. The other thing I'll add to that is that often when I do this kind of thing, it doesn't necessarily come naturally, or it doesn't happen automatically the first time the right way. And so feel free to tweak it too, right? So you try it, you might hit close to the mark, and then you can tweak it so that you're right on the mark. So yeah, I've become much less of a perfectionist the first time and more of a, am I even in the ballpark? And then if I am, then I can, you know, then I can get it where I want it.
Yeah, not putting this pressure on yourself or saying it's just all about willpower. It's all about working harder and forcing it, but figuring out what fits well and improving things. That's great. Well, cool. Thanks, everyone. Chuck, thanks for being here as a panelist. Josh, thanks so much for joining. We really enjoyed the conversation. Folks, if you want to follow the podcast, we're on Twitter at r_n_radio. You'll see episodes announced and other links. Or you can check out devchat.tv to see our past episodes or other podcasts in the network. Thanks, everyone, and we'll catch you next time for another episode. See ya.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit cachefly.com to learn more.